Welcome to You Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Today on You Drink Indiana Radio, we can't help but be thinking about the Super Bowl and what one local chef is doing at tonight's Taste of the NFL fundraiser to fight hunger here in Indianapolis. Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 tells us what he had to do to get ready for tonight's Taste of the NFL event in Phoenix and about the importance of the fundraising event. And we'll check in with caterer Vicki Higuera of Three Figs about a Super Bowl game day menu as well. We'll also be talking with City Market's Stevie Stays Kirsch and Chelsea Marburger as they prepare for an upcoming conference in Barcelona, Spain, where they'll be sharing the story of our Indianapolis City Market with public market professionals from all over the world. We'll also hear from Andrea Humoya about the new hard cider operation called Ash and Elm that she and her husband Aaron will be launching this year in Indianapolis. And we'll also start talking Valentine's Day and other special events with Ocean Air Executive Chef Neil Andrews. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. It's the day before the Super Bowl, so I hope you have your pork or chicken smoked for any sandwiches you might be planning and that you have the guacamole and salsa ingredients ready to chop. Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 will be doing plenty of prep himself today, but he'll be preparing for a much bigger event than a room full of guests gathered around the TV. The chef is in Phoenix right now getting ready for tonight's Taste of the NFL event, a massive tasting event that raises funds for food banks in each NFL city. The Taste of the NFL is definitely a fabulous foodie event. Chefs and football players from each NFL city are on hand to mingle with attendees who get to try some seriously good food. I was able to attend the Taste of the NFL event when Indianapolis hosted the Super Bowl a few years ago, and I was impressed with both the scale of the event and with the seriousness of its efforts to help fight hunger. Now, that event was actually held in the warehouse of Gleaner's Food Bank here, which really helped to drive home the importance of the event. Chef Greg Hardesty has been working with Taste of the NFL for 9 years and tells us why fighting hunger is a cause he can get behind and how we can all help.
I've liked it because when I first started, you know, and I've always wanted to be pretty charitable because the people that I worked for in L.A. and San Francisco were relatively charitable. I'm probably a little bit more, but it's just something that I felt like was one of the things that I wanted to focus on as I owned my own restaurants. But I sort of bounced around, you know, it was whatever charity it was. And getting involved with this and seeing the impact that one large organization can have, or one that's just very focused, sort of defined what I want to do, and that is use my restaurant as my platform to say, all right, I make food. Who can I help? Let's help people that don't have food. So I've kind of liked it for that reason the most.
So that's what the organization does. It raises the money for food banks in the NFL cities, including Gleaners here in Indianapolis, right?
Correct, yeah. So there's 32 cities with NFL teams, and I think there's a Pro Bowl city. I'm not sure. Maybe that one wanders around or, you know, kind of there's also the Hall of Fame.
That's right.
So yeah, there's, you know, 32 to 35, food banks that get rewarded. And, each year the host city gets a little bigger percentage. So we got a, you know, pretty good percentage, you know, 3-4 years ago, for Gleaners. But, other than that, after that, then the other 32 minus the Super Bowl city, divides it up equally.
Now, tell me, as a chef participating in the Taste of the NFL, which is the night before the Super Bowl, so you're there Saturday night before the Super Bowl. What do you do? How big of a effort is it? It seems like it would be very daunting.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of support. Generally, like this morning, I got up and came into work about 6 a.m. and packed up my stuff and shipped it. Overnight, I went to the UPS or the FedEx store and overnighted it. So my food will arrive tomorrow, hopefully. I have had one year where it got lost for a couple days and didn't get there till the day of the event. But hopefully my food will be there tomorrow afternoon. I'll fly out tomorrow morning, get there, check in, do all the, you know, get all my credentials and all that sort of thing. And I'll head over to wherever the food goes. And so it's different every year. You don't know where your food's going. So it really helps to be really prepared and do something that's simple yet, you know, you're trying to be creative, but you're not trying to reinvent the wheel because you don't know what you're going into. I've cooked in tents with, you know, propane stoves. That's the kitchen that they give us. And we're expected to do 1,200 to 1,400 portions. You know, they're small portions, but still a lot of food. So you just never know what you're getting into. So, yeah, the food will get there tomorrow. Hopefully I'll go check it out, make sure it's all arrived safely and intact. And then Friday, I usually prep a little bit. Kind of depends on the dish. I try to do as much as I can ahead of time that without, you know, really sacrificing quality for the event. And then Saturday is, you know, the main prep day. And we show up at the site and take a bunch of pictures, have a rah-rah session about, you know, why we all do this. And then it's 6:30. Lights go down, and we start serving. And it's usually about 2,000 to 3,000 people, depending on the size of the venue. When it was here at Gleaners, it was a little smaller.
Was that a small one? Because I was at that one, and it seemed very big to me. But wow, if that's on the small end, my goodness.
Yeah, it was because I think it was tough. You know, Indianapolis is great at doing these events, but we don't have a ton of huge spaces, and so they searched for quite a bit of time, I think, trying to find the right space, and they finally said, let's just do it at Gleaners. And Gleaners is a huge facility, but it's very kind of choppy. You know, it's basically a warehouse with giant speed racks in it full of food, and so it was on the smaller side, actually. It was spread out, but it was pretty small.
So once you get to the day of the event, how does the rest of your day go? Do you get to actually enjoy any of the event at all?
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's 6 or 6:30. I can't remember. It's the same time every year. I'm never ready on time with anything that I do, so I'm not sure what that time is. Whatever it is, it's a half hour when I'm ready. It's really fun. There's generally lots of help. They usually have a local culinary school with students come in and they help and they help serve. And once the event starts, it's just a big party. And they don't really want the chefs behind the tables cooking and plating food and whatnot. They want us out in front meeting the people. Each chef is paired with either a current or an ex-player that has played for that team. Ours is Ken Dilger, who is actually a good close friend of mine, so that's always great to just be with Ken for the night. And he signs autographs, and there's a big auction, and so our goal is to kind of push the Tasty NFL and get people to get excited about the auction items and bid them up, and, you know, so they want us to have fun. So, yeah, it's a good fun time. Gala Wines is a, I think, maybe 16 to 18 year partnership with the Taste of the NFL. They provide all the wines, so there's wine at each table that is paired with the course that we're doing. And so it's a fun event. I always compare it to Zubilation on mega steroids. I mean, it's just huge. And obviously there's usually not a tornado that comes through for Taste of the NFL like there is for Zubilation every year. But so it's a great time. And then at 9:30, they tell you they shut down. We are done because they want those people focusing on the auction.
Sure.
Because it's all about raising the money. It's friendly. It's not pushy, but they are very strict. And at that point, we're free to break down and then enjoy the rest of the evening.
Now tell me what dish you'll be making this year.
My dish is, I'm calling it a spicy yuzu glazed, yuzu garlic chili glazed chicken cav with a Napa cabbage jalapeno slaw. Basically what I did was I took the drumstick and I took the two little muscles off of each side, so it almost looks like a chicken oyster when it's raw, or when it's cooked, it looks like it. But I'm just going to roast those off and toss them kind of like a buffalo wing in a little yuzu garlic chili glaze, and then set it on top of that salad. So kind of a fun little, and it's the calf of the, calf muscle. So I always try to be a little bit, tongue-in-cheek a little bit.
Well, it sounds like it's fun, but like you said, it's also for a good cause, and people can continue to support that cause, right? So they can still donate.
Yeah, and the beauty of this is, and you can donate if you're from a different city, that'd be fine. But if you go to kickhungerchallenge.com, you can click on the Indianapolis Colts link, and you can donate anything from $1 to $5 to $5,000, or the sky's the limit. And the beauty of the Kick Hunger Challenge is all the money that goes into the Colts, and they sort of make it a competition between the cities, who can raise the most money. Seattle actually wins every year. I think I raised $6,700 this year. Seattle, I think, is at like $68,000. I mean, it's just unreal. But at any rate, all the money that's in the Colts kitty there goes right to Gleaners. It's not divided up. It's separate. So, and every dollar at Gleaners feeds three people, three meals. So, if you do $10, it's very simple. You're not even going to feel it, but 30 people are going to get a meal.
So you can have an impact. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's really cool. And, I did this sandwich competition 3 weeks ago, and we raised about $6,700, like I said. So, close to 21,000 meals in one day. Just to come in and spend a little money, and it was a bunch of chefs in the city, and so it's easy to make a difference. It's one of those charities that you really feel like you really are making an impact, because those dollars go right to people's stomachs.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4 and the Indianapolis Chef for Taste of the NFL. To donate to the Kick Hunger Challenge that benefits Gleaners Food Bank here at Indianapolis, go to tasteofthenfl.com. The Indianapolis City Market is just a treasure here in Indianapolis, a historic building right in the middle of downtown that houses our public marketplace. Now, the city market's focus has changed over the years as it has evolved from fresh market items to more of a lunchtime destination. But with more and more people living downtown, the market is once again evolving to meet those needs. And it's that story of our Indianapolis City Market that Executive Director Stevie Stays-Kirsch will be sharing when she and the market's Director of Civic Engagement, Chelsea Marburger, attend an international public markets conference in Barcelona this year. I caught up with Stevie and Chelsea recently to hear about the event and to hear about what they plan to share at the conference and what they hope to bring back.
So Project for Public Spaces out of New York City host the International Publics Conference. This will be the 9th International Public Markets Conference. This is the first time that they've held it outside of the United States. So they're super excited, although there are challenges with hosting events, as you can imagine, abroad. But we are going to be speaking on the shifting models within public markets. So how do they evolve? How do they change in a nebulous way to meet the needs of the consumer? How do they change when, like what's happening here, you have vast amounts of development, residential and commercial, to in your immediate area? And so we'll be talking about how we change and shift to meet the needs of the consumer, and also how to use space within your public market to generate revenue streams, a space that possibly is underutilized. We've done this, you've seen this actually with the catacombs, a space that has been, on site since 1883 and has never really been used for much more than storage and haunted houses and spooky stories. But we found a way to generate some revenue from it in a meaningful way and do some programming that is interesting that people want to see and want to attend. And again, with our mezzanine level, which wasn't part of the original market, it was actually added in the 70s, believe it or not, it's great for lunchtime seating for people who come to the market and want to have some lunch. pretty dead space the rest of the time, so of course Tomlinson have room there. But we also have a cart market program that we can generate some revenue for small businesses who don't quite have the capital yet to make a full-time commitment to stand ownership in the market, but they want to be here in the more flexible way and are testing a product. Nice. And it's a fairly inexpensive way to do that.
Well, tell me a little bit about the presentation that you'll give and how, just kind of recap how our market has evolved and what you're going to share about that.
One of the things that Project for Public Spaces folks were keenly interested in is the collaborative effort that we have, especially with the West Wing of the market, which of course now is called the Platform and houses different nonprofits who work together in a very synergistic way to accomplish common goals, not only within our own organizations, but reaching out to other organizations and making those connections in meaningful way for people to, again, achieve certain goals. That's one of the things that Project for Public Spaces was really interested in hearing more about, because that's what a public market often should be. They aren't always, but they see it as that community-driven outreach programming effort that we do very well. They are also really super interested in the East Wing now that it's become the Bike Hub YMCA. And again, at one time, both the wings housed City Market vendors, City Market merchants, who have now all been ushered into the main market hall. And these opportunities then arise to use these spaces in different ways. So the East Wing, being the Bike Hub YMCA, right off the cultural trail, is another area that they're super interested in how that operates and how it evolved from housing maybe one or two City Market merchants to a pretty vibrant space now.
Well, now you have, you know, dodged, like you said, dodged the wrecking ball in the past here with our market. And, you know, maybe people aren't aware of that, but there's a lot of good lessons that you've learned in that and keeping your market relevant.
It's true. And twice in City Market's history, Indianapolis City Market's history, it's been faced with the wrecking ball. And the public outcry has been such that it demonstrates how emotionally tied people are to their public market and how they use it. And so hundreds of people showed up at the city-county building saying, you can't do this. You can't take our public market. You know, back in the day when it was truly a raw foods market where people shopped for their staples was great. But as you saw people after World War II flee to the suburbs to establish the supermarkets and their own communities, the city market shifted to meet the needs of the downtown employee base. So they wanted a lunch counter, which was great. Now that the residential component is coming back, we are once again shifting to realize a renaissance of that raw foods movement and local foods movement to meet the needs of people who are coming through. And, you know, people shop so meal-specific now. My mom shopped for 2 weeks at a time. Her cart was overflowing. People shop for, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? I want a steak. I want a French baguette. I want a lime for my cocktail. And something else. So we really, our mission is to meet the needs of those residents who are in our immediate area.
Now, what do you hope to get from your trip? What do you hope to bring back from going to this conference and hearing what all these other markets are doing?
We have an opportunity to learn from the best of the best. So we'll be talking and meeting with public market masters from all over the world. And we want to hear about programming efforts. We want to hear about revenue streams that they've dreamt up that are different than what we're doing here. We want to hear about how they engage their community, how people in their communities use their public markets. It's just a chance to really learn from the best and hear best practices from other public market masters.
Chelsea, tell me why you are involved with the market. You went to Barcelona, and tell me what that experience was and then why you were connected, why you're connected with the city market like that.
Sure. I was actually really lucky my junior year of college and was a nanny for a family. She was studying art history, and someone said, hey, we need a nanny that speaks Spanish that just wants to hop on a plane to the other side of the world. I was like, yes, please, right here. And we actually spent about 2 months just bopping around Spain, and we had a week. I had a weekend off. And so I hopped on the Renfe, which is like this high-speed, 210-miles-an-hour train, and ended up in Barcelona, stayed in my first hostel, and just ran around Barcelona completely by myself for 4 days and just fell in love with markets. I went to La Boqueria, which is kind of the host market for this. Went to San Miguel Market, the fresh fish markets right next to the sea, and I fell in love with this. They're so vibrant. You see every generation from, like Stevie said, the little old lady that's getting all of her groceries to families with kids to the hipsters to just everyone at these markets. And I said, I want to be a part of this. And when I got back to Indianapolis, I was in August, and I said to myself, I was like, I need a job. What am I doing? I just got back to the States. What should I do? And I actually cold called Stevie, and I said, I've never been to the market. I want to work for you. I will do it for free. I will clean toilets, whatever it is. I just want to be in this building. Didn't take no for an answer.
But what is it about a public market that you find so appealing?
Sure. I was traveling by myself, and so I'm in this city, and most people don't know, but they don't speak Spanish in Barcelona. They speak Catalan, which you're almost better off speaking Chinese because they're not similar at all. And I was by myself, and I was drawn to these locations. It had fresh food. I'm traveling on a nanny budget, so I'm like, where can I get the cheapest wedge of manchego and a baguette just to get through this day? I'm traveling with a backpack. I mean, it's just, you just see so many generations. You see so many people there for different reasons. You see people, and I wanted to know why they were doing it. Like, why are you here? I get that you're getting your groceries, but it's the middle of the day on a Tuesday, and it's part of their daily routine. It's part of what they do with their life there, and it's very European to have markets and that sort of thing. And I lived downtown at the time that I came down here. I was like, how did I not know this existed? This is a huge asset. I'm a college student. I can come do my homework here. I can have a group project here. I can get a beer here. I can get my ice cream. I can go to the produce market. I can get flowers if it's someone's birthday. Why wouldn't I want to be right in the middle of this?
Going to this conference in Barcelona is pretty pricey, and you have a campaign that's helping you raise money so that you both can attend. So tell me a little bit about that.
We do. Chelsea did a great job setting up an Indiegogo campaign, and I believe it's Indiegogo.com. Mm-hmm. And if you search Market to Mercado, that is our tagline. We have raised about $700 so far. Speakers who attend the conference get a little bit of a stipend. It's $100 off registration, which is $650. So it's not cheap. But we have raised about $700. I'll be talking with some other civic leaders next week to see if there are other funding opportunities for us to go to. Of course, we'll be chipping in our own monies too. But City Market being a nonprofit, which a lot of people don't realize that City Market is a nonprofit. And just because you see a bustling main market hall with vendors doing extraordinary business, it doesn't translate to the coffers of the City Market per se. So with such a lean budget, we're exploiting all different kinds of opportunities to get us there, but we'll find a way.
We've been talking with Stevie Stays-Kirsch and Chelsea Marburger of the Indianapolis City Market. To donate to the fund for the Barcelona conference, go to Indiegogo.com and look under Market to Mercado. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. Well, the craft beverage community in Indianapolis just keeps growing, what with the craft breweries, distilleries coming online around the area. A new venture in that category, though, is Ash and Elm, a cidery that's being launched by Indianapolis residents Aaron and Andrea Hamoya. After they hosted a recent tasting event that featured two of their hard ciders, I sat down with Andrea to learn a little bit more about Ash and Elm and how a hard cider operation gets started.
It's called a cidery, and we are hoping to supply ourselves with juice from Michigan that will then ferment and distribute in Indianapolis at bars and restaurants and have a tasting room similar to a beer brewery where you can visit and try the different pints and the different flavors that you maybe couldn't find out in the restaurants.
Now, when are you? What's the time frame on this? When are you hoping to be up and running? I know you've already had a tasting party.
Yeah, we hope to be up and running by the fall of this year. That's kind of a best case scenario because we're still in the fundraising process and trying to secure a location. But if we can get those two kind of big topics tackled in the next couple of months, we might be able to hit that. Otherwise, it'll be when we get our permits and when we get the build out taken care of.
Now, tell me how you go about starting a cider making operation here in Indianapolis.
For us, it started with a lot of research. We went to Conn's Fine Wines and Crown Liquors every weekend and bought as much as we could find from as many places as possible. There's huge cider industry in the States on both of the coasts and in New York and Virginia, Seattle. So we tried all of those, and then we tried all the ciders from around the world where, you know, there's a great heritage of cider in England and France and Spain. They all have different flavors of cider and different types of cider that they're known for. And then we took a couple trips. We went out to the West Coast. We visited and met with a bunch of cider makers in Seattle and Oregon, and then did the same in Michigan. So we really did our groundwork and research by traveling and talking to people about how would we do this in Indiana. And so they had a lot of great insight. And the next step for us was meeting with some orchard partners, which we've done. We have a couple orchards that we've talked to and learned a lot about why or why not having a large amount of juice from Indiana orchards would work. And our goal at the start was to have as much juice from Indiana orchards as possible. But they told us that we actually import apples to eat because we can't grow enough to feed the state. So that kind of quickly became not realistic.
But Michigan, of course, is known for apples. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a regional kind of thing. So you're hoping to keep it regional then?
Yes, we have a supplier in Michigan that we've already identified and made some, you know, I think 20, 30 gallons of cider out of that juice that we hope to use. And then we still want to work with the orchard partners in Indiana to make smaller batch Indiana-specific ciders that can really showcase what we can do here. And hopefully long-term, you know, maybe more orchardists will jump into the apple game.
Now, talk a little bit about how you came to the idea of opening a cidery and how you came up with the name, for example.
We came up with the idea because we've always made a lot of beverages at home, specifically alcoholic beverages. My husband, Aaron, brewed beer for the last 10 years, and he's got a great portfolio of all these wonderful beers. And he's an engineer, so he has meticulous notes from the last 10 years of beers that he's made. And then we started making wine together about 5 years ago and then started doing cider a couple years ago after a trip to Spain where we had some cider that was really great and very different. Changed how we thought about cider and what it could be. So we've been experimenting for a long time, and Aaron has always been the guy who has a dozen different business ideas running through his head that he's always talking about. And so finally we kind of sat down and said, let's actually think seriously about this. If we want to do it, we can't just come up with ideas and then drop them as soon as we think of something else. Let's really take a hard look at what we're good at and what we like to do and what might make a good business sense. And cider was near the top of that list. And then the more we researched and the more we made and the more we tried, we realized it was a really great fit for the two of us. And our name is Ash and Elm Cider. And that actually is also a bit of a long story. We had chosen a different name that we had used for about 6 months when we found out another brewery was opening with the same name, which was shocking and sad. So we went through a list of as many names as we could think to find out if those were available, and had a really hard time. And eventually Ash and Elm came from, you know, listing things that we both like and that our families like, which include a lot of hiking and a lot of outdoor. Aaron's dad is a botanist. My dad is an avid bird watcher. So we've just spent a lot of times in the outdoors. And so Ash and Elm was kind of a reflection of that heritage of just appreciating nature.
Now, you said you're hoping to open in the Indianapolis area. How is it? Is it hard to find a location? You know, is it challenging? You know, I would think that that would be a very pivotal part of what you're trying to do, and kind of, you know, help drive how people look at the business.
Yeah, that is definitely a difficult part because everyone has this idea of a beautiful old historic building right in the center of downtown with walkability, and those places are few and far between now, especially since so many breweries have opened in the last 5 years. One of the hardest limiting factors is we need really tall ceilings because we have fermentation tanks, so, you know, 12 feet high at a minimum is hard to find, and then it also needs a loading dock with access for trucks, and so those two kind of disqualify you from a lot of places right downtown. So we're looking in the near neighborhoods, Holy Cross, the Heron Morton area, and would love to find something, but it's tough, and we hope to find something soon that works.
Now, what are some of the other challenges that you face in opening a new business, an interesting business, one that we don't really have a lot of here in town? Anything that has been, a challenge along the way?
I think one thing that hasn't already been super challenging but will continue to grow in the challenge in the future is that a lot of people haven't really tried a lot of different kinds of ciders. What you can find at the grocery store, your kind of mass market ciders, are growing in popularity in Indianapolis and nationwide, but they are kind of a small segment of the types of ciders that exist. So I think one of the big things we'll have to do is educate people in Indianapolis about what cider can be, and it's like beer and wine, where there are so many different styles and so many different flavors, and it's based on how you ferment and when you ferment and with what ingredients you use. So I think when we tell people that we're starting a cider company, we get responses of either I don't like cider or I love Angry Orchard. And there's such a huge range that we really hope that people will be willing to try it for the first time and see that maybe there are some ciders that they definitely like, even if they consider themselves more of a beer drinker.
Where can people go for some more information or to follow your progress in this?
We have a Facebook page that is up and running. It's Ash and Elm Cider, and you can search for that in Facebook. And we also are on Twitter and Instagram, and that's at Ash and Elm Cider. And then we also have a website. Right now it's just a landing page, but it's ashandelmcider.com.
Well, we've been talking with Andrea Hamoye of Ash and Elm Cidery. To learn more about the new cider startup, go to ashandelmcider.com or look for it on Facebook. The Indianapolis restaurant community has certainly been growing lately as new restaurants and food businesses are launched around the area and keep pushing the local food movement forward. Larger restaurants also tap into that with special events that involve local chefs. The Ocean Air Seafood Room, for example, will be hosting an upcoming fundraiser, and Executive Chef Neil Andrews tells us a little bit about that, as well as about his Valentine's Day menu and even an oyster shucking event that he has planned.
We have our Valentine's Day, obviously. It's a 5-course menu coming up, and then we have a Red Cross dinner coming up as well, a 5-course menu. We're pairing with other local chefs, Abby Maris from Bluebeard, Leighton from Mesh, and Jonathan Brooks from Milktooth. And we did it last year, so our second year for doing it. We're looking to do a second charity event later on in the year, possibly partnering with WFYI as well. We have an oyster promotion coming up in November, hopefully doing a shucking contest. So sorry, just lots of things.
Well, now that sounds fun. Do you feel a downtown community, you know, with the downtown restaurants?
Definitely. I've worked downtown for probably the past 10 years, and I love it. I love being downtown. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I know most of the chefs kind of grew up working with them. Me and Abby worked together at Recess, Elements for a good 2-3 years. So I like the camaraderie that we have amongst chefs, and we're all just trying to make food better in the city.
Now, do you see the food scene growing like that? There's been some discussion, you know, lately about, you know, how pushing the food scene forward might be a little difficult. So are you seeing some progress in that sort of arena?
Definitely. I mean, there's more and more local small restaurants coming up. I mean, the farm-to-table aspect is definitely picking up, and we're in a great spot for it. In Indiana, we have amazing local farmers all around us, and I think people are starting to realize and appreciate that more. But yeah, I definitely see the food scene picking up. Diners are definitely more discerning and starting to understand more about food, I suppose. And willing to look for and eat what they want.
Do you find that? Do you find people to be a little bit more adventuresome maybe than they were 5-10 years ago?
Definitely. I feel people don't scoff so much. Like even pork belly, something that chefs love, people wouldn't like it. Or, you know, again, same with the belly of fish, the atoro, salmon belly. You know, we usually save those for the best cuts to do like little amuse-bouches and what have you. And people will turn their nose up at it, but or they used to, and now they thank you for it.
Well, that's kind of fun to see the progress. Now, how do you incorporate, you know, some of the farm-to-table stuff? You know, you're at a big restaurant. You're part of a restaurant group. How do you do that?
We definitely have our own food section that we are able to have our own hand in. We print our menus daily. We write specials every day. We have special soups, special salads, special sides, entrees, everything. And I try to work as closely as possible with farmers, especially within Indiana. But obviously, we're not getting a whole lot of fish. So, like with oyster vendors, I'll call them personally and make sure that they're doing things the right way and make sure everything's really just work as closely as I can with the farmers. So,
now tell me a little bit more about maybe some of the specials you have coming up, the Valentine's Day menu, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, it's a 4-course menu. It's $90 per person. There's a good amount of samples on there, and they're just kind of some of my favorite specials that I've put together over the years. There's caviar on there. There's a short rib pasta. There's plenty of options on there. There's grilled skirts, or I'm sorry, a strip loin. Plenty of fish options. We have Nantucket-based scallops. We're one of the few restaurants we've actually... Ocean Air as a whole is kind of licensed a specific captain. He's doing all our farming for Nantucket Bay Scallops, and they almost all exclusively go to Ocean Air's. So I try to just stick to local, or stick to stuff like that and make it really nice. So,
now tell me how Devour Downtown has been going. Has that, you know, been going well this year?
Oh, it's been great. It's kind of been surprising. In the past, you know, we love to get all the people in there, and even if, you know, we're happy to have everybody in there, and it gives us opportunity to really showcase what our restaurant can do. I've really filled out the menu as much as possible, offering foie gras and caviar and high-end items, as well as your simply cooked fish as well. And generally in the past, I'd say our sales have been roughly about 75% of the people eating off the Devour menu, and it's probably even shifted further down that people will come in and see something they really want that's on the regular menu. And we're happy to have anybody in for Devour or regular menu, but it gives everybody a chance to see what we're really capable of doing.
Any things you're looking forward to particularly?
Summer for summer vegetables, but just watching, again, the city grow, the restaurant grow, and really just being a part of things.
Well, we've been talking with Ocean Air Executive Chef Neil Andrews. For more information on the upcoming Red Cross fundraiser, check theoceanair.com or look for the restaurant on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. I don't know about you, but when it comes to hosting a get-together like a Super Bowl watching party, I can always use a little extra inspiration. So even though it's last minute, I stopped in to talk with my go-to party planning person, Vicki Higuera of Three Figs Catering. And while I may be late to getting my game day menu put together, Vicki had plenty of ideas that I think maybe I can still pull off in time for tomorrow's game.
Oh, there's lots of things you can do. You still have plenty of time to put together some Super Bowl. You have to have, in my opinion, Super Bowl, you have to have wings. There's a couple of things you have to have. I'm hearing guac. I didn't know about the whole guacamole thing, but wings to me say football. So I think you have to have wings. You have to have good beer. And I like to have something substantial. So we always do a pulled pork, and then you can kind of go in a lot of different directions. If you don't have time to smoke your own, which you still have time, but you're getting late on it, but you can buy pulled pork at lots of different places. So some of my favorite places, Goose the Market, I know they're doing it. Also North End Barbecue, you can always call and get pork from them. Or King Ribs. And you can always, they have pork by the pound also. So I like to do that, and then it makes it easy for people to, and you put out a lot of different things.
Now, tell me a little bit about your thoughts on why a Super Bowl party, though, is a little different from a regular party that you might throw.
Well, because if you come to our house to watch football, it's mandatory. You're watching football. I mean, that's why you come, why we're all getting together. And
that means you're watching football, too.
I like to watch football, too. So I don't want to have to be in the kitchen. As you well know, most parties at our house, there are several people in the kitchen drinking, eating while I'm cooking, which is one of my all-time favorites. I love that. But during the football game, not so much. I want to be able to have everything ready pregame and then enjoy, drink a beer, enjoy watching the football. And then from halftime on, depends on who's playing. This year, probably won't want to. I'll watch all of the halftime commercials, but then probably won't watch the end of the game.
So in this case, the beginning is important, and the planning before the game is important, so that you can have the spread all out and ready to enjoy, right?
I think so. There's certain parties that, if no matter what party planner you talk to or what article you read or bring up online, it's like, ooh, have everything ready ahead of time. To me, that's a little fabricated and a little, nobody ever has that kind of time. It never ends up that way. And a lot of the times you don't want to have to do stuff ahead of time. You know, I like having things that come off of the grill or out of the oven or whatever, just as people are there. So I think that, but if you want to watch the beginning of the game, some of that stuff needs to be done. At least you have to think about it ahead of time. If you are doing something, which we'll do this year, we do our casa wings, which are chicken wings that we do on the Big Green Egg. Key to it, we have found, is doing a rub and then cornstarch. If you sprinkle a little cornstarch, lay all of your chicken wings out on a sheet tray and rub them really well, and then sprinkle a little cornstarch over the top of them and let it set for about 45 minutes. And then you put it on the Big Green Egg. And they take about almost an hour to cook. But the cornstarch helps draw some of the moisture to the top, to the skin, and it makes them so crispy, which is what we were always missing when we smoked them or did them on the egg or the grill or whatever. And so that cornstarch really helps that. And then I just toss mine with butter. You have to use good butter on this. Julia would want you to use good butter. And Frank's sauce, I tend to use the chili lime. And with the rub on it, then you get some of that gooiness, but it's not messy. I hate slimy chicken wings.
So you have a couple of pregame things that you've mentioned. Then how does the party progress? How does the food for the event go from there?
We have a pregame, we call it pregame, King David dogs that come right off the grill too. And then I do a platter that sits literally out next to the grill that, as you well know, I'm a condiment queen. And I have like some Stonewall Kitchen roasted garlic marmalade. Oh, a new one. It is one of my new favorites, grapefruit and sea salt marmalade. And it cuts the richness of the hot dog itself. And I just like that combination there. And then some house ketchup, which has adobo in it. It's pretty zingy. And then a couple of mustards and just things to dip in. And then picks. And it's a finger food. And then, so all of that is kind of ahead of time. I also always, if you're coming to my house, you're always going to get cheese. So on the board will be some sort of blue. Maybe one of my all-time favorite right now is Vermilion River Blue. It is from our friends at Ludwig Creamery Farms over on the state line. And then some sort of fresh cheese, whether it's a goat or a brie or my favorite right now, Trillium from Tulip Tree, or their fresh mozzarella. Oh, my God, that is so good. And then some sort of aged cheese also. And some Marcona almonds and then these roasted peaches that I was telling you about that I really want to try. I think they will go delicious with the fresh mozzarella. So that'll be going, and people can just kind of nibble on that. And then at halftime, we will have smoked all of the pork, and we'll do a pork shoulder. Don't want to get into all of the intricacies of the different cuts of meat, but find a good butcher. Talk to them. They're going to guide you about what all of the different cuts are, how much you want on it, how much fat you want on it, if you want the fat back on it, what the poundage is, that kind of stuff. They're really going to guide you in that direction. And so we'll take the pork off, wrap it in towels, put it in the cooler. That is key. And let it set for a couple of hours before you pull it. And that is going to let all of those juices and everything go back into the meat. Pull that, just do a big platter of pulled pork. Then we do some corn tortillas and go to the Mexican Mercado and get those. Big stack of them for a couple of bucks, and they're going to be really good. Do not just use the ones from the grocery store. And then also some yeast biscuits, and then lots of little pots of stuff. Again, pico de gallo, guacamole, chili verde, salsa, sweet and sour barbecue, sweet barbecue sauce, some sour barbecue sauce, some pickled pineapple, a little something pickled in the way of a kimchi kind of. This year we're going to do a lime marinated cabbage and onion. Again, you can make those things, or there's lots of people out there making really great stuff. Hidden Pond, from any artisan, are both doing really good kimchi things that go perfect with smoked pork.
So you would have all of that out. This sounds like a sort of a build yourself kind of thing. Again, trying to make it easy on you and your guests so that everybody can get a little something.
Everybody gets what they want. You can go really spicy with it. You can go pretty mild with it. You can also, for my vegetarian friends, you don't need the pulled pork. When you have all of those other elements, you can kind of build your own tacos. And then that way they can just build their plate and take it with them wherever they want to go. You don't need a fork. You need lots of napkins, but other than that, you don't really need a fork.
Now, do you do any sort of a sweet thing at the end? Is it the kind of an event that you need any kind of a dessert thing, or when you're done, you're just kind of done?
And you know what? No, we do dessert. My daughter Marina loves to bake and is a very, very good baker. So I'm going to put her in charge of, she'll do brownies or bars, her choice. Right now she is on a caramel salted sea salt brownie kick, which is fine with me because it happens to be one of my favorites. We also will do little mini size because, as you know, I collect a lot of glassware. And I have these really cute glasses that I think will make a perfect floats. So we'll do some sort of stout or a porter or something, depending on who's doing what right now, and some Grater's ice cream, some Grater's vanilla ice cream. So,
well, that sounds like a fun way to end, a football focused day. Are you rooting for anybody in particular?
Oh dear, I can't root for the Colts anymore, right? They're out of it. Is that right? No, I am not rooting for anybody in particular, although I do, I love the colors of Seattle's, of their uniforms, and I think Russell Wilson is he's a pretty smart kid. I think he's got a lot going on, and being the Patriots, my daughter is a huge Patriots fan, so that is always a contention here. But in light of everything that's going on, no, I'm not going to root for anybody in particular. And I won't even make any Deflategate jokes or anything like that.
We've been talking with Vicki Higuera of Three Figs Catering, who you can find on Facebook. Well, I have been talking food with caterer Vicki Higuera for 10 years, ever since I interviewed her about an article on specialty foods, and she steered me toward Jungle Gyms, that fabulous Foodie Land grocery store in Cincinnati, where the sign in the parking lot really does say Foodie Land. Since then, I've been on a mission to try her recommendations, which began with a jar of Dalmatia fig jam, and which now has sent me in a search for that grapefruit and sea salt marmalade that she mentioned. And I've been so pleased in recent years as more and more specialty shops have opened in Indianapolis. So even though we lost the Corner Gourmet and Frazier's, we've gained lots of other options as well. Goose the Market is one of the most popular, and you'll certainly find plenty of terrific specialty items downstairs. That is, if you can get past the meat counter upstairs. More recently, we've seen R2Go open at 11th and College, and I'm very excited about that shop, run by local award-winning chef Regina Mihalik. The selection of specialty items, fresh local foods, meats, cheeses, and grab-and-go foods fill a void in that near downtown area. And Wildwood Market in Fountain Square opened to fill a similar need in that neighborhood. But I also want to mention some of our ethnic markets, like Carniceria Guanajuato and, of course, Saraga International Supermarket, which are great resources for ethnic ingredients, all of which help make it a great time to be a food fan in Indianapolis. Next week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we'll hear about Slow Food Indy from board member Ashley Brooks, and we'll hear about what that organization is doing to help grow the local food community. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio here on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. I'd like to thank our guests this week, Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4, Stevie Stays Kirsch and Chelsea Marburger of the Indianapolis City Market, Andrea Hamoya of Ash and Elm Cidery, Chef Neil Andrews of the Ocean Air Seafood Room, and caterer Vicky Higuera of Three Figs. And thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.